This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Jay, this is your father.
Okay, that's not a compliment.
That wasn't good. No. Okay. All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute.
Sounds like a drunken German.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, a man whose approval ratings are suddenly through the roof, Dave DeShriver.
Mike, thanks for having me on the show again. My approval ratings are off the charts. And when you start from zero, you know where to go but up. So
your highest approval ratings in 2 years.
Yeah. Well, no. High school, I was off the charts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My popularity was at the top then.
Yeah. Is that right?
Since then, it's really been kind of downhill. Mm-hmm. Somewhat depressing.
Dave, I don't think that's fair. You know, I knew Dave back when we were in our early 20s, and Dave lived in this great group house up near Tenleytown, and man, they always knew how to throw down a great party.
Yeah, that's true. Popularity was pretty good back then.
It was good back then. A couple of kegs, you know, the smoke machine.
Well, I was dispersing beer with smoke machine, so that's why I was popular.
Yeah, yeah, some great tunes.
Oh my God, yeah. A lot of fun.
And that floor in your kitchen that always was at risk of giving way.
Right, that thing almost collapsed on multiple occasions. In fact, we actually buttressed it with some with some 3x5s.
But that made it more exciting, you know, that back in the day, that just was the element of surprise.
We were learning while doing that.
Well, we were.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, Dave, hey, lots to cover this week. We're glad to have you on the show. Rick is out gallivanting about somewhere this week. He's a man always on the move.
All right. Or where is he? Do we know?
I don't know.
He's out and about, some conference?
He's out probably making some big fat speaking feed.
Right.
You know.
Right. He has wisdom to dispense. So.
Well, he does, actually.
Right. Not to the extent that you can do it without a podcast.
Well, you know, he used to say that the reason that he would get these big speaking engagements, and I wouldn't, for example, is that I was blogging and therefore giving the milk away for free. But he's now doing the same, and he's still getting the speaking engagements. I'm not saying I'm jealous, but I'm a little jealous. And we just bought a big new house, and I need some extra money. So,
well, congratulations on the purchase.
Oh, thank you.
Right.
Appreciate it.
Maybe you should just target international audiences.
That's not bad, actually. That's not bad. Okay, lots to cover, as I was saying. So we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly, Amber's Research Minute, and special intern Marina. I'm not saying she's a special intern. I should have said special appearance from intern Marina on What's Up With That. So, Daniela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Hey, guys. Question number one. In response to the Shanker Institute's call for common national curricular materials, a group of conservative-leaning folks issued a critical response, pushing back against the national curriculum. How is this counter-manifesto going to shape the debate on national curricula and standards?
So, what do you think, Dave? This has been got some good play, especially on Monday this week.
Right. You know what? Yeah, I feel like this has been brewing for some time. Yeah, a lot of conservatives sitting on their hands with the Common Core standards and then the common assessments, and it was, you know, legitimately enough states were running this, but then it eventually filtered down to curriculum. We knew that was going to happen. So when that happened, I think that was somewhat like the bear trap, like something like clap. Now they're in. Now they have a legitimate claim to say that maybe this is the federal intrusion that they've been warning about.
You know, the statement itself, which is not very long, it's 3 pages long, not a whole lot to it.
No.
It's interesting. Partly it's against the Shanker Manifesto calling for several national curricula, really, is what it calls. It says, look, basically, hey, we should give teachers curricular materials and not just ask them to figure it out on their own, which to me is not that controversial, but can get twisted into sounding like a national curriculum. On the other hand, I think more problematic for those of us that support Common Core is this question about the federally funded curricular materials that are getting developed by the testing consortia. And as you remember, what happened last year was that the Department of Ed had extra money left over after the testing competition because they didn't end up giving out any money for high school assessments. So they decided at the last minute to give that money to the two testing consortia to allow them to build out stuff that would be useful for teachers. That's not crazy. I mean, anybody would say, hey, we know from standards-based reform, 20 years of it, we haven't done a good enough job giving teachers good materials. But it raises the question now, these are federally funded curricular materials, and there is this ban on the Department of Education from getting involved in curriculum.
The ban is there, and are districts forced to use that? They're not compelled to use it, but they will be using the assessments. So is that some underhanded compelling? You know, I get the argument. It's kind of a slippery slope thing, but I think this is just a way to unravel the broader effort, and then to kind of throw it into this trite big government versus local control argument.
Yeah, here's what I think. I mean, tell me what you think about this. I think that, number one, the Department of Ed should make it clear through a statement or maybe a letter to Congress or something saying that these materials are voluntary and are not meant to be mandatory in any way, and we will prohibit anyone from making them mandatory, right? Number two, I think the Common Core folks should encourage states to pass laws that say that the State Department of Ed and the State Board of Ed are barred from mandating any particular curriculum or instructional approaches on the local school districts, just to cut it off at the knees and to say we're serious about this stuff being voluntary.
Right. I think it's going to be driven at the state level. I mean, you have, what, 28 new governors, 24 new chiefs out there, all wanting to put their imprint on this. So let them do this. Let them take control. And I don't even think the Department of Education should make a statement on this. Just back away and with back channels, have the state governors and chiefs step up.
Okay, good. Topic number two.
Okay. Last week, the Chamber of Commerce released an ESEA reauth proposal penned by former Ed Secretary Margaret Spellings. What were the big takeaways?
The big takeaways for me is that the Chamber of Commerce is paying Margaret Spellings a lot of money, I assume, to rehash the exact same proposal that she and her staff came out with in 2007. I mean, Dave, this is practically fraud that we're talking about here. Why is she getting paid to come out with something that has nothing new from 2 years ago? And may I add, barely anything new from 2001.
It's a snoozer. I mean, it's just a snoozer. It's the outlines are set. There's really nothing new contributed to the conversation.
Why is she stuck in a time machine? I mean, it's maybe she holed up in some.
She has strong beliefs in. That's fantastic.
I mean, maybe, but, you know, all along with that Osama bin Laden was in a cave, not getting any news information. Maybe Margaret Spellings is holed up somewhere. She has this, like, she's been cut off from the conversation. Margaret Spellings, the conversation has moved on.
Or maybe she believes that the conversation will move back to her. Maybe she's right. Maybe she sees something we don't see. But
maybe she listens to one of those radio stations that's like, you know, 90s hits all the time.
Right. And there's something about kind of the set deadlines, intervene in poor performance. I'm just not that interested in some of this. And maybe because the debates or the contours of the debate aren't new, but I think there really needs to be, if you're going to make a bold statement in the Chamber of Congress, really focus on something a little more innovative, focus on something a little more disruptive, and we didn't see that.
I mean, isn't it fair to say that this would arrive with a thud in Congress, particularly among Republicans? I mean, it basically says keep AYP. It says keep the timelines, keep the annual measurable objectives, more or less keep everything. This is not the mood that congressional Republicans are in.
Nor is it the way to sell those ideas either. That's the big problem here. So even if you believe in those concepts, going straight at them in this environment, probably not advisable.
Well said, Dave.
So I just want to say, before we get to question number three, I love 90s rock radio stations. They're fantastic.
Yes, because they remind you of your early childhood.
Yeah, for me it's 80s rock.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, question.
Oh, by the way, the other day I was typing the phrase I3 into my iPhone, and the spell check changed it to U2. Significant? What does that mean?
I'll think about that.
Yeah, I think you should.
Yeah.
Because, Dave, I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
Oh, my God. Can we go on?
Question number three. Just a few weeks ago, Illinois unions and lawmakers were praised nationally for their ability to collaborate, negotiate, and agree on far-reaching education reform legislation. That's all unraveling now. What's going on in Land of Lincoln?
I love this story, Dave. I mean, look, it always seemed too good to be true that they had the reformers and the unions. They locked themselves in a room and they came out with this bill to reform tenure and LIFO and other things, and they got this agreement, and then it passed I forget if it was the House or the Senate, unanimously. Well, lo and behold, the union president in Chicago finally got around to reading what was in the bill and realized that it would have extended the school day in Chicago, which has the shortest school day in the country, and that it would have also changed some rules around arbitration. Anyways, I think her members went crazy, and she now is claiming that the reformers pulled a fast one on her.
Of course they pulled a fast one. Yeah, at the last minute when you didn't miss the key details or when you missed the key details. I think they just have cold feet on this matter. And so what may have been heralded as great reform and collaboration may have had a bunch of asterisks, which either people overlooked or they didn't pay attention to in the first place.
Look, I mean, it's easy to beat up on this union leader. It's pretty clear to me that she agreed to something that she now can't sell to her members. So she's basically lying and saying, oh, I didn't notice that there was this provision in there to extend the school day. All right. But, you know, it is a reminder, and Mike Antonucci has always been very good about saying this, is that, you know, these unions, they are democratic organizations, and their presidents can only go so far, and they can't get too far out in front of their members, or else, you know, they get kicked out of office. And so when we have to pay attention to the internal dynamics of these teacher unions, and instead of just thinking that these presidents nationally or locally can just basically be persuaded to do whatever they want.
Can we make a stretch and make an analogy to the union leadership in Pakistan?
Oh, yes, you can.
I think we can do that.
See, so, I thought you were going to go NFL is where I thought you were going with that.
Pakistan NFL, no. You know, no. Similar. I think we can probably circle that around, but that's for the next show.
Yeah.
So either she was incompetent in what she was doing, or she was purposely deceitful.
Yeah.
Either way, when it came out, it was bad news.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the connection.
Yeah. So we'll see how things are going. I have to say, it makes me feel a little bit better about our predicament in Ohio, where we haven't ever been able to find any common ground with the teacher unions. So we were thinking, boy, what are the reformers in Illinois doing that we're not doing? Well, it turns out that...
at least it seems like they're in Ohio, they're negotiating with you honestly then.
Yes, exactly.
So that's
it's all right out in the open.
Right.
Thank God
for that.
You know, hostility, anger, and distrust on all sides. And we're all open about that. Okay, that's the end. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly.
Embrace the hate.
On that really happy note.
On that happy note. Hey, you know, it's not just the unions we have to fight in Ohio. You know, our colleagues are busy fighting right now. David Brennan, the number one, or maybe number two, Republican donor in Ohio, the guy who runs White Hat Management. They run a bunch of terrible charter schools.
He has run into some trouble recently.
Well, and he has been trying to get slipped into the budget proposal, a proposal that would strip all accountability from charter schools in Ohio, that basically would allow for-profit charter operators to operate with no oversight at all, to take buildings that were paid for with public dollars and claim them.
How would they operate with no oversight at all?
They basically get...
Well, they have school boards, right?
No, that they'd get a charter and then they'd be able to have the charter themselves. The management organizations would be able
directly
to
giving it to the management organization, absent of agreement with the school board that would oversee them.
That's correct.
Well, that's convenient,
and the quote authorizer would be the Ohio Department of Education, known to be completely inept at being.
Yeah, they have nothing to do, so I'm sure they can get into the details.
Yeah,
right.
So beautiful, beautiful stuff. Thankfully, to his credit, the governor is against this, even though he received a lot of bucks from Mr. Brennan. So, hey, we're fighting on the left and the right in Ohio. That's our motto.
Yeah.
Fordham, we fight.
Well, you fight everyone, particularly when you look at the national curriculum.
Well,
you and Jay Green, my God.
You're can we, by the way?
You're talking about spatting.
Can I say something? I mean,
you guys should do this in private.
I know, my good friend Jay. I mean, basically he's calling us weasels. What's up with that?
Right.
I want people to point out, and he also made fun of me for my Twitter addiction last week, which I've fessed up to, and I've admitted, and I'm working on, okay? So...
Though he also did post a picture of the Empire, the Death Star, relating it to national curriculum. So maybe it makes an analogy of you to Darth Vader.
Right.
That could be a compliment.
Jay, this is your father.
Okay, that's not a compliment.
That wasn't good. No. Okay. All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute.
That was like a drunken German.
Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
How are you doing today?
It is a beautiful day. I'm in a very good mood.
Let's wrap this up and get out there.
It's true. It is gorgeous out there. We should do it outside, except I think the ambient noise would be a problem for producer Joe.
No, true. It's a live setting.
Oh, we could do the live setting. Okay. Next time, rooftop next time, people. Rooftop.
Good.
All right.
Okay, Amber, what's up this week?
All right. This week, we've got a pretty nifty study by Pat Wolf and Julie Trivett called School Choice and the Branding of Catholic Schools. It's a unique study that hypothesizes that Catholic schools have a distinctive brand identity, similar to how corporations brand themselves in markets.
It examines whether this brand affiliation impacts preference for Catholic schools and persistence in them over time. Analysts define the Catholic brand as having high academic quality, a safe disciplined school environment, lots of parental involvement, religious activities, among other areas. They studied a parental survey, enrollment, and program persistence data from the Signature Scholarship Program, or SSP, in Washington, D.C. during the 1998 to 2001 school years. So a little bit dated. The program is similar to what we know. I mean, we know the Opportunity Scholarship Program. It's not that one. It predates the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Anyway, provides scholarships of up to $3,000 for K-12 families below the poverty level to attend private schools in and around D.C. They find that parents do indeed prefer private schools that provide high-quality academic programs. That's not a big surprise. 55% say they wanted to enroll their child in a Catholic school if they won the voucher lottery, yet only 60% of schools participating in the SSP are non-Catholic. Interestingly, Protestant Christians prefer a Catholic school as their private school of choice, even though a number of Protestant schools participated in the SSP. Catholic parents tend not to defect from their professed religion by preferring a non-Catholic school. So some interesting little nuances there with religion. Finally, this is the most important finding. All else being equal, students who attend Catholic schools are more likely to remain in the voucher program the following year, so not real long here, than students attending other types of private schools. Yet there was some evidence that attrition exists because parents were disappointed in the brand. I don't want to get into that. It's kind of complicated. Keep in mind, this is a fairly small voucher experiment. It was over a decade ago. Still, they conclude that brand identity can be a time saver when you're choosing schools. So, different. It kind of reminds me of the Kip branding. You know, lots mm-hmm. of talking about, you know, like how do you kind of get your brand out there if you're a choice school.
Rollers on the knuckles.
Yeah, that wasn't part of the identity, no.
Come but on, yeah. Everyone thinks that.
No, I mean, it is, right? I mean, it's well
it's
known.
Discipline.
The discipline was in there, yeah.
If you say Catholic schools, I think most people have a clear image. You picture uniforms, you picture nuns, you picture the rulers.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Amber, this is interesting that this was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Did they mention anything about the sex abuse scandals in terms of the Catholic school brand?
No. That was not part of the brand identity.
No, but right? I mean, depending on the timing, right. I would think yeah. that's now an issue because yeah. that you worry that the brand has been damaged because now when you say Catholic school or, you know, I wonder if that brand right. has been significantly damaged by that scandal.
Yeah, interesting. Something that they did not examine.
They glossed over that one.
Not even footnoted.
Didn't even address it.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, becoming a little bit of an issue in the whole, you know, sainthood for Pope John Paul.
So was the entire purpose of the study to make the point that brand recognition kind of bundles ideas and concepts and saves you time in making decisions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what
they're
saying.
They could have just done this with the Clorox or some other detergent, right?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, you know, kind of take some of those market ideas and education. It's Fordham actually has a study in the works that kind of tries to attempt to do some branding of our own with school choice.
Well, and I wonder if there's any other brands out there that really are widely. I mean, even Kip, I don't know in many places if that has any meaning to people.
Well,
how about
TFA, Teach for America? They have a brand identity.
They have a brand, sure.
Kind of a reformer, innovative type of person.
Yeah, but say a model, like a school model, like what else? I mean, public school has sort of a brand. Catholic school has a brand. I'm not sure. Prep
right.
school, maybe.
Yeah,
what else
school.
Would fall into that category?
I would think you'd orientate it towards the, particularly in the South, to the football teams.
Yeah.
So you're talking about a particular high school like Clemson High. Mm. You're probably going to associate it with their athletics, and that's the brand.
Right. Interesting stuff. Okay, so what are we going to, what song are we going to pick
so
for this one?
So since we are talking Catholic schools, we have ex-Catholic Madonna singing Like a Prayer.
Like a dream, no end.
So, Dave, do you like old Madonna or new Madonna better?
New Madonna. I like the rave stuff.
Yeah, I do too. I have to say, I mean, I'm impressed she has really evolved. Right.
If I was cooler and go to the clubs, I would be all over that.
Absolutely.
I don't even know if they play to the clubs. It sounds like they do.
Yeah, I would, you would think so. You live right in the city. Why don't you go to the clubs?
There are no clubs where I live. Or are there the clubs that are there?
Yes.
Well, I can only go with my wife.
Because?
Because it's I live right in the heart of the gayborhood.
Yes, and let's face it, Dave's
so a good-looking
man, and he just doesn't want to get hit on all night long. Okay, so it is now time for What's Up With That with special guest intern Marina.
Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes,
sir. Marina, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Thanks, Mike.
Is this your first time on the show?
This is my first time on the show.
Wow, and you know, sometimes we ease people into it by having you say, ask questions or something. But this is a bit shot here to go all the way to what's up with that.
Wow.
So give it your best shot.
All right, here we go. On the morning after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, Jane Elliott, a third grade teacher in a small, all-white Iowa town, allowed all of the brown-eyed students to treat the blue-eyed students as inferior for the day in an effort to teach a lesson about discrimination. Elliott's decision to simulate bigotry sparked a national controversy that simultaneously accused the lesson of being a cruel experiment on white children and praised it as a necessary lesson in understanding, acceptance, and empathy. That was 1968. Today's story is about Jessica Boyle's racially diverse fourth grade class in Norfolk, Virginia. In order to bring a Civil War history lesson to life, Boyle turned her classroom into a slave auction, asking black and mixed race students to act as the slaves, while the white students took turns buying them. What's up with that? Boyle actually thought a lesson of this kind could benefit her students in some way? It's no secret that discrimination still widely exists in the U.S. today, and she chose to separate these kids by the color of their skin and not something inconsequential like the color of their t-shirts or shoes. Don't students of color already feel a type of discrimination that Boyle was trying to simulate? While Boyle may have thought she was following Elliott's footsteps, she was doing nothing of the sort. In an attempt to teach her students about the horror of slavery, Boyle instead reenacted a racism her students may already be too familiar with. As a teacher, there is never an excuse to put children in the position she did, and after 6 years in the classroom, Boyle should have known better.
Whew. Wow. All right, now let me ask you this, Dave. If she had done the same lesson, but as Marina had suggested, separated them by shirt color or
right.
birthday or something, do you think that it would have been an okay lesson to do that in a classroom still, to have kids pretend to be slave owners and other kids have to pretend to be slaves?
Fourth grade?
Fourth grade.
I think fourth grade's a little early for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it you got a difficult situation where you don't want to sugarcoat something or mm-hmm. cover it up because it is what it is.
Right.
Fourth grade may be a bit early for that. Maybe like a middle school play or maybe middle school activities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she could have reached her objectives by doing something differently than the race. Maybe shirts, but then to set it up in a slave auction situation.
Yeah.
I mean, then again, you dive into this. Dive into this gray area.
So I've got a lot of personal experience with this. So back before I came to Washington, I was at this outdoor education center, basically camp. And we would have, you know, mostly fifth graders or sixth graders coming out for fifth or sixth grade camp. And we had a program called the Underground Railroad. This was in Ohio. It was actually in an area where the Underground Railroad had gone
through. Right, from Rochester, New York. I know all about it.
You know all about it. So we would do this living history program where us teachers, the way it would start out is the kids would come to this one area and they were basically asked to close their eyes. We enacted a slave auction. And we teachers were basically the slave owners and auctioneers, and the kids and their parents or teachers were basically the slaves. Now,
right.
There was some orchestration into how this went, and of course we had training in how to do this, it was definitely meant to be somewhat horrifying experience to have people belittled and yelled at and just the whole idea of being sold. And then they went off in these little groups and they pretended that they were escaping and on the Underground Railroad. When I read this story, I was like, look, I think we did it pretty well. And it was a powerful experience, emotional experience.
What was the age group here?
This was fifth and sixth graders, generally. So, you know, that's why, and when I read that, I mean, clearly doing it by race was, such a bonehead move and terrible. But, you know, this question of, can kids that age handle this concept of, hey,
right,
let's see just a little taste of what it would feel have felt like
yeah.
to be a slave.
And I, in some ways, I like the idea of addressing the issue head on. It's a difficult issue, so let's tackle it, and it's going to be awkward. But fourth grade, what I want to know is, did she just do this on her own, or did she work this through with the school leadership?
It seemed in the article that the school leadership didn't realize that this was going on, but at the same time, there isn't much detail that was given at the same time.
So
you do wonder. You do wonder. I wonder about the age as well. I learned about the Holocaust when I was in fourth grade. I remember very vividly, and I did feel old enough at the time. But in teacher training, they tell you to avoid that.
Is that right?
My professors told me that fourth grade is way too young, but my personal experience tells me differently.
Yeah. No, these are hard questions. You know, I mean, I've tried to start explaining some history to my son, who's only 3 and a half. You know, you try to figure out, how can I explain it in terms that make sense to him? But I don't know. I'm torn on that idea of saying that we have to avoid some big topics until the age. But anyways, we all agree that it was crazy what that teacher did. And hey, in a world, in a country with 3 million teachers, every week we're going to find at least one who uses terrible judgment. And we find them here on the Education Gadfly
Show.
Okay, Marina, well done on your inaugural edition.
Thanks for having me.
Crushed it. Yeah. Super.
Absolutely. Hope to come back. Dave, great to see you.
Oh, fabulous to be here.
Always nice having you on the show.
Yeah.
And understand your wife has a bun in the oven. And
she does do July, so it's going to be I have one more month or about a month and a half of sleeping.
Yes.
Then after that, I'm told it's gone.
It is gone for a long, long time. So.
Wow.
But but maybe you'll come on sometime, and you know, if you want to, we'll just have some fun here on the show.
Yeah, I'll just curl up in the corner and take a nap.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds good. All right, well, till next time.
I'm Dave Shriver.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.